Thank you for tuning in. You are listening to the Economics for Rebels, the podcast series of the European Society for Ecological Economics. Not too long ago, it was an act of rebellion to pursue economics as if nature mattered. This rebellion continues. This is a podcast dedicated to exploring the economics of just and sustainable transformations. Conversations with and for those who are ready to act on rapid and radical change for people and planet. Welcome to our podcast. I am your host, Alexandra Kovács, and you are listening to the Economics for Rebels podcast. Many believe that wanting the best for both the environment and humans just makes sense. However, when we introduce ecological economics concepts of providing good life for all within planetary boundaries, the most vicious problem that we face is to do with power structures. Today's guest, Bengi Akpulut, has been arguing that our current understanding of development is detrimental to real change and development, and development is most often just a way to maintain the power structures. Bengi is a political economist, assistant professor at the Department of Geography, Planning and Environment at Concordia University, Montreal, Canada. Her work focuses broadly on the political economy of development, including issues of political ecology, agrarian and environmental change, state-society relationships, social and environmental movements, and gender and household work. Originally from Turkey, she has been an advocate of acknowledging the strong relationship of environmentalism with malcontent of existing regimes. Welcome, Bengi.
Thank you for inviting me. It's very nice to be here.
Before I turn to academia and ecological economics, I had worked with development policies, and I started doing this just before Hungary was joining the European Union, just a decade after the economic regime change. And I remember that we never once questioned that the idea we were importing from the EU was the only way ahead. So we took it for granted that what they offered as development was the only way. And it was only after a decade of working with development policies when I started to question whether something might be fundamentally wrong with the presumptions behind these concepts. Because whatever we did, I didn't feel that we were really on the right track to create a better world. And this is actually when I turned towards ecological economics. And as we both come from semi-peripheries, I think your argumentation of why we have totally misplaced beliefs in what development might mean is really similar. How do you think the concept of development should change if we wanted a more environmentally and socially just world?
Well, I don't know if it can change, actually, or if we should be trying to change the concept. But I think, I really appreciated that you told us your story, but even if we don't want to keep the concept of development in some shape or form, me saying kind of those on our side, let's say, but we still have to engage with critically with the notion of development and why it is not working, or why it is actually detrimental to a just and environmentally sustainable world. I don't know how, but I have a few ideas. First of all, I think even the question that how should we redefine, or what should we do, how should we define the concept of development, by us as academics, as technocrats, as experts, is, but like in a way, in a decision, implying a decision we're making for how should people be living. So even like the question itself or the engagement, the kind of initiative itself to engage in this question is hierarchical, and it's very much inherent to the idea of development, right? Because the development enterprise and the development project, and by that I mean both the intellectual and ideological project and the kind of institutional constellations that come with it, are built on this business of defining what progress is and how should other people be living. And unsurprisingly, kind of coincidingly, it's not only that some people are doing it for other people, so it's a hierarchical kind of relationship of some people defining what should be the goal, but it also is sitting on top of existing hierarchies, right? It's often institutions in the global north, and institutions and people who are benefiting or perpetuating the colonial patriarchal capitalism are defining what should the other people be doing. So in a way, even like engaging with this question is kind of like, who am I to say? Because that's, I think, that's part of what is colonial and what is wrong with the concept of development. It's always a group of a minority that sits at the top that defines what should be done and what should be what should be the target for the rest. So I guess from moving from that, I think for if we are ever going to do this or like maintain some notion of development that is useful either politically or analytically for building a just and a sustainable world, the first step should be that this concept should be pluralistically defined. And by pluralistically, I don't mean kind of a narrow human development framework in terms of kind of more indicators or more variables than growth or GDP per capita, but in a radically pluralistic way, kind of ontologically pluralistic, with kind of voices from the global south more generally, or south of the global north, with ideas, cosmologies, worldviews, practices of living well together, that should be the foundation of what development is. So there should be kind of a radical equalization of knowledges of development, first of all. And this is something that I think the colonial scholars have been saying anyway. But I mean, this is kind of a lot more of a, I guess, a bigger project of redefining the concept of development. But again, as a concept, development had emerged in the post-colonial quote unquote context where former colonies were acquiring their independence, and the global north and the colonizers were kind of, there was the kind of the colonial relationship as it was formally defined until then was not sustainable anymore. So development kind of came to be a concept that substituted that relationship. So it is fundamentally an unequal and colonial relationship in that sense too. And this kind of redefinition or kind of struggling and fighting against that kind of the coloniality of development, I don't think it's only our job as academics, or it can be our job. It has to be, we have to be kind of paving the way for already existing social movements and struggles against development or alternatives to development, post-development, pluriverse, whatever you want to call it. So we cannot capitalize on this as another set of experts. But at a more kind of, I think, smaller scale, and this is part of what my academic work has focused so far, is the equation of development to economic growth. And that's a concrete way in which development has gone wrong. And I mean, there are many reasons that economic growth and endless economic growth cannot be sustained biophysically. But also it has many, not only kind of environmentally, but also socially and politically, growth is not necessarily something desirable. And it's not only because, I mean, kind of more tying into debates around growth and development and inclusive growth, it's not only because economic growth has not been equal or the benefits of growth has not been equally shared. Costs of economic growth, so this social dislocation, a lot of kind of the social suffering and environmental and socio-ecological costs, let's say, have been unequally shared as well. And the ideas of, to draw on some of the kind of degrowth thinkers' ideas on autonomy and democracy, increased growth, increased scale of economic activity, and increased scale of infrastructure takes away our ability to govern ourselves, because those kind of big structures require often big centralized institutions and bureaucracies. So there are many reasons why growth is not desirable that I won't get into, but development, at least the first thing we should be doing is to really sever that link between economic growth and development. And also, although there's a lot of lip service paid to it, when you look at, I mean, you worked in development institutions, I'm sure it is something you've seen, but when you look at the development literature, now like the state of the art is human development or sustainable development goals, right? So no one is kind of talking about, hey, like we should, on paper, no one is talking about GDP per capita as a measure of progress. It's kind of shush, shush, we don't.
Even but though it is a Trojan horse in the sustainable development goals.
It is, I mean, exactly. It's not the first one, but it's I think the seventh or something. So, and in human development and in the Human Development Index, which was kind of the state of the art when I was doing my PhD, it's one of the capabilities, income is one of the entitlements or capabilities to, or one of the means to expand capabilities, to speak in Amartya Sen's parlance, but it was still there. And And when you look at the broader kind of development economics literature, especially, oftentimes, even when the costs of the social and ecological costs of growth is acknowledged, or development as, or growth as development is acknowledged, the proposed answer to it is growing more, because there is kind of this belief that, oh, okay, like we're gonna break a few eggs on the way, but like then we're going to compensate, or we're going to compensate the losers or lift all boats. So this kind of growth is kind of an answer to everything. And not only kind of the inequalities that are created through the process of development as growth, but also the very fundamental nature of capitalism, which is a fundamentally unequal and unjust system, right? So the class conflicts have been, so that kind of that one portion of the society always makes money off the other portion, has always been blanketed with growth. So there's also kind of this critique of growth literature coming from how growth is used to dislocate political conflicts on how to slice the cake. So if you make the cake bigger, more and more, you don't have to kind of get into that question, right? I mean, you can give a little more to the working class without actually sacrificing a lot from your portion. So I think the notion of development is beyond, like, to come back, it's beyond reparation. But I mean, I think it doesn't mean that as ecological economists or heterodox economists or rebellious economists, we should stop engaging with that debate. Because if we withdraw from that field, I mean, sustainable development goals will just strengthen its hegemony, right? So I think and there are many movements that are already kind of challenging the idea of development or the idea of development as growth. So we have to engage with it critically, kind of with a sober mind, not with a, I think, delusion that we can actually change the concept of development, but we should not withdraw from engagement. But as I said, radically pluralizing, making the concept radically plural, and kind of undoing the hierarchy of the kind of the global north's definition of development should be the first kind of goal. But at a more pro or convo, definitely exposing and criticizing the kind of the centrality of economic roles in existing conceptions of development is like the way to go for us.
The association between development and growth is so strong that actually in Hungarian, the two words are not totally dissimilar. And when I talk to people about degrowth, they keep calling it de-development, simply because, you know, it's kind of the same in their heads. But when you suggest that, basically the way I understood it, that you suggest we should actually get rid of this term altogether, but if we can't get rid of this term altogether, we should somehow make it more plural and start thinking in different terms. But can you give us a few examples? Like, now we know what people mean by development: better GDP, maybe better healthcare, maybe higher age expectancy. But what else? I mean, what would this plural entail?
That's a very good question. I think, let me start, and I'm not sure if you were planning to ask me this at some point, but Turkey is not very different. It's not the same word, development and growth, but development, one word we use for development is kind of more progress, and the other word we use for it is kind of taking, it's almost like taking off. So, and it's very, growth is more literally growth, but they're very much synonymous. And when we say I've fell in the middle of many fights when I said the kind of word degrowth. It's a lot more, I think, familiar now, but it was a taboo 10 years ago. And I mean, it is, at least in the context of Turkey, it has to do with how the entire, I think, the state kind of and built on kind of catching up, growing, developing, and catching up with the global north. But and it has a very important part in kind of, I think, the people's, the society's psyche. But how can we redefine, or what kind of, how can we make that field or kind of as domain a little more plural, I think we have to turn to practices and kind of and ideas of living together from the global north, from the global south. And oftentimes they are not as kind of encapsulated as growth or measurable, kind of reducible to indicators. But for instance, the indigenous peoples in the so-called Canada and the indigenous peoples in the kind of the entirety of North America, as well as indigenous movements in South America, their ways of living and relating to both each other as humans and kind of their non-human kins, which they do see as kind of as their kin. So it's another clan, and it's that relationship is also based on reciprocity and consent and care, and not care in terms of caring for the environment as like conserving some pristine nature, but care as kind of being attentive to the interdependency. So, for instance, living in reciprocity and care with others is one idea that is central to these cosmologies, which is very much outside of development, right? But when you think of kind of how these principles coming from indigenous ways of living and kind of practices, some that are kind of that we can more easily wrap our heads around are sufficiency, for instance, rather than having more, having enough. We can talk about justice and kind of sharing more justly or equity. And that could be an important way, that could be an important thing for people. I mean, that's another thing. I mean, it's not that I'm not trying to fetishize in a way kind of the indigenous cosmologies, but I think even in the global, even in like the global north, there are many communities who would, I think, for whom living sufficiently, like it's, or living in sufficiency or living in a just society would be important. I think once we, and this is kind of something that degrowth scholars talk about as well, once we decolonize the imaginary from kind of the primacy of economic growth as a societal objective, it also gives, it also kind of leaves space, liberates space in our imaginations to think about what other goals and kind of principles we might want to prioritize. I think the same goes for the idea of development. Either to kind of to decolonize the imaginary from the idea of development or from the primacy of growth. So what would development mean for a majority of people's living and coexisting? I think there are other principles and objectives and values that would emerge. But also, I don't think this is supposed to be a collective process as well. I think kind of making that field more plural, the definition of development more plural. Already we have a lot to learn from, I think, existing social movements, but I think there should be, if we were to build more participatory, plural and democratic societies, I think this is something that needs to be collectively and kind of more democratically discussed, if not development, so what kind of question. But as I said, I think people have, people do not always fit in what kind of the neoclassical economics picture them to be, to have a market rationality, to always like to have an insatiability, that they always want more rather than less, or that like they are able to substitute kind of monetary gains for other things that they sacrifice from. So So I think there's a lot that already kind of we have. If given, like, yeah, I think we have a lot historically and contemporarily, especially on social movements and communities in movements who are demanding a different life, who are operationalizing other principles than growth and kind of, let's say, efficiency. And part of it, I think, we've seen also in the post-austerity movements in the southern Europe, when, like, after the crisis in places like Greece and Spain, and that's how I think the degrowth movement also kind of took off in those contexts, where people were seeing what they want is not growing like this. They were kind of expanding their imaginaries towards what kind of a life they want, which is different than just having more.
In your work, you emphasize that development now is kind of reproducing the power structures that we already have. Now, even if we accept that we don't want development that is kind of forced upon us by the existing power structures, we still have the problem of them being in power, because by definition, that's why they can force it on us, because they are in power. So what is the sequence where this can change?
A good question. I don't know, but let me speculate on it a little bit. I mean, it is, first of all, I mean, when we think about strategy like this, I guess it is more contextual, and it depends on what kind of social forces are kind of pushing for this change, right? But I mean, in the context of Turkey, for instance, that I've studied in my empirical work quite extensively, one idea that I worked on and I kind of try to develop with my co-authors, but also by myself, is that development is kind of, or this promise of development as growth, is what the Turkish state was building its legitimacy and hegemony on. So even if, and that's what I was kind of partially referring to a few minutes ago, it's very important for Turkish people too. So it has a very strong, it's a deep-seated kind of societal objective. What I mean by kind of gaining getting legitimacy on is the idea of Antonio Gramsci, a Marxist theoretician of the state and state power, who says every modern state needs to govern by consent from the society. Oftentimes, modern states, I mean, they have to portray themselves as a neutral agent who is there for the collective benefit of the people. And oftentimes they do it as portraying their role as fulfilling the collective interest, the kind of national popular outlook. And in the context of Turkey, and I think for many other countries as well, it has been fulfilling development. So in a paradoxically way, fulfilling development only, or even like the promise of it, it works to cement state power. So it kind of reproduces state power. But in a more broader way, and it is the case in Turkey as well, but I think in capitalism in general, what we were discussing a minute ago, how development serves for the powerful, for the ruling groups, to keep their power by kind of redistributing a little bit of that kind of that material benefits that come with development, and the kind of also the symbolic benefits, right? I mean, that like now I live in a developed kind of country, kind of symbolic. So like the appeal of development is not only material. So they kind of, it's almost like a bribe, but it's kind of, it's been used, it's a part of capitalism that lower classes or like the ruling class redistributes a little bit of the benefits of development to keep them in check, to keep them happy enough so that they don't rebel. So this is only two ways in which kind of development itself helps to save the system or perpetuate the powers of those who are in power. And that's by no means limited to these two ways. So, but the question you pose then is kind of important, because where do we start? I mean, in one way, we can start anywhere, right? We can challenge development and kind of build a movement kind of more based on movements who are challenging or countering development processes, right? And that could be peasants, that could be those who are dispossessed in rural areas, that could be those that are dispossessed in urban areas. So all the kind of social and ecological dislocations or environmentalism of the poor kind of ecological resistances. So that could be a base of the movement. And the good part is by countering development processes, you're also countering power structures. So that kind of gives us a way to see a different kind of coalition of forces, social forces. Then like there is a way for those movements to build alliances and meaningful kind of broader movements with those that are those movements that are more directly maybe countering power structures. So the workers' movements, for instance, or broader forces for democratization and equality. So it's kind of where you start, I think, in that context would depend on, it's more of a strategic question and it would depend on the balance of forces. But I think this conception of how power and development works gives us kind of a different way to see existing struggles and movements. But one thing I think is important is, the development process as a process of, capitalist development process is also a process of dispossession, and dispossession in the not only in the sense of kind of people losing their common assets, but more broadly in the sense of people and communities being separated from their autonomous means of living and socially reproducing themselves. So in that sense, capitalist development is the process of making people workers too, and making people unable to actually fulfill and to their needs and their subsistence by themselves and kind of work for someone else. Not always, but this is kind of the general kind of process of capitalism. So what this means is oftentimes people are reliant on the very development that they are suffering from in order to actually make a living, right? So like anyone who's studied environmental conflicts might have come across this. This is definitely something that I have come across in Turkey, that a factory, a dam, a power plant, whatever is gonna come and like is gonna take them, is gonna dispossess these people and push them off the land, and they're already in a position of not making enough of a living from the land. So they actually, although they are fighting against this company, they would also be working in that company, but also like the fact that they're working in this company takes away from their ability to fight, which is to say kind of more broadly, unless these movements and unless people build at the same time while they're countering development and countering power structures, build their own let's say, autonomous spheres of socially reproducing themselves, autonomous systems of provisioning, that actually they don't have to rely on the capitalist development process or the state in order to fulfill their needs. These movements are not going to be as strong. So I think one strategy, wherever you want to start, needs to be for movements to build their autonomous basis of a needs-based, let's say, subsistence economy. How that would look like, I mean, that would look like, I don't know, having their own kind of food provisioning practices, having their own whatever childcare systems, having their own pension systems, or taking care of each other autonomously. It could look at many different ways, but this is an idea that comes from a lot of scholars who work on commons and commoning too, which kind of are talking about. I mean, Raul Zibechi talked about this when he's talking about the kind of new wave of social movements in Latin America starting in mid-2000s, how they also build, as they're struggling against power, they're also building their structures of subsisting and sustaining themselves. Silvia Federici and George Cofensis have been writing about how building these kinds of commons is important for movements, because otherwise they will never be able to counter the very forces that they are reliant on as they stand. So that's my two cents.
You also work with feminist perspectives, and what can we learn from the feminist movements when it comes to trying to redefine development or power structures, for that matter, because that is the core of feminist movements.
Well, there's a lot, I think. Well, first of all, there's a long history of feminist critiques of development and feminist critiques of capitalist development and growth in particular. And this kind of a big chunk of this work, especially feminist development economics, economists have shown how processes of development affects or have disproportionate impacts on different genders. And a lot of, again, this work kind of not only focuses on how gendered and feminized or gendered, let's say, the formal labor markets are, but also that the field of social reproduction, which is kind of not the production of commodities, but the production of people, all the kind of work that goes into social and ecological regeneration and reproduction is a feminized field. And when kind of development processes somehow destroy or damage the basis of livelihood, women take on more work, or they are disproportionately affected, or they take on more work in order to kind of to support the households or the communities. For instance, a huge literature kind of exists on how structural adjustment programs, that was kind of the primary tool, instrument of development in many of the countries, not in like outside of the global north, of public services and public, especially public social services, health, education, care, when they were privatized and the state states stepped back from providing these services, it was often women who started providing health, education, care services at homes for unpaid and unrecognized manner, and increasing their burden. So actually, when you look at kind of processes of development, what looks like development oftentimes is accompanied by a large burden, an unpaid labor burden on women and nature, but on women as well. So one part that we can learn from feminist economics is that these processes of development do not develop everyone equally or do not mean the same thing. And it has a very different implications for women and men, and not only in terms of labor burden, but also in terms of opportunities, quote unquote. But then something that I was kind of implying just now, there are also these, I mean, another kind of big field of feminist economics that actually make the link between women's unpaid work, feminists and eco-feminists, let's say, political economists and economists, who make the link between people, women's and nature's unpaid work and development a lot more explicit, and saying that development, and especially capitalist development, is only possible because a part of the population was rendered or relegated to the field of performing unpaid labor for capitalism. And it's not only women's social reproductive labor at homes, within households, within communities, but also the work of nature, the work of colonies, the colonized peoples and spaces, we can say immigrant labor in the global north, so which is kind of all this feminized domains of production and labor. So feminism tells us, I think, like unpacks and deconstructs this idea of development a lot more, very strongly, a lot more stronger than any other account, that it is development on the shoulders of a portion of the population. And to refer to Silvia Federici's very, very strong work, the dispossession of a part of the population, dispossession and the primitive accumulation of women's bodies and their autonomous control over their bodies and reproductive abilities. The feminist account is a very powerful account of both kind of how development or at whose expense development happens, but also, and this is oftentimes overlooked, feminists have also theorized how this field of social reproduction, if it was organized, because the social reproduction is not based on profit or accumulation, it's based on meeting needs as a kind of an organizing principle. It doesn't mean that it can be unequal or very unjustly organized. But looking at social reproduction as an inspiration to build a needs-based, a subsistence-based economy, a provisioning-based, not a subsistence-based, but so they have theorized how this field can be organized more justly, and including gender justice, and be used as a model for us to organize economic relations after. So, Silvia Federici, as I just referred to, talks about this in terms of commoning social reproduction. Maria Maez talks about provisioning economy. So there are ideas that come from feminist economists about what, if not development, then what, kind of, and also values and how to organize work, how to organize compensation. It's quite inspiring. But as you said, feminism also comes with, I guess, maybe a strategy to fight power, right? And that's oftentimes when I'm asked to speak on kind of heterodox economics and how to change economics, not developments like we're talking about now, but economics. The answer I give is that it's not often economists themselves who change the field. It's often social movements. and the field is pressured so much that it has to change. And the example I gave is the feminist movement. So it's not, it wasn't because of a bunch of like economists were like, oh yeah, we've been avoiding or we've been ignoring this field, like the lives of women and their realities. It was the feminist movement, literally pushing the boundaries of the field, of the discipline, and then they had to kind of pay attention because women were on the streets, women were in their classrooms, women were on campuses, they were blockading their offices and blockading buildings, so they had to see it. So I think feminism in that sense gives us that lesson that change happens only if you push for it. And in another sense, I think one thing that feminism taught me is, it's not like the work, it's not like the workplace in a factory, right? I mean, the shared reality we have, it's kind of fragmented in different households, in separate households, in separate communities. So spatially, we're not in the same place to discover our subjective. Of course, we build those places and we share those places, but when you think of it, what this is also kind of when feminism made me realize that I might not be in the same place temporally and spatially with my movements, with other women that share the same reality, but we're all fighting the same thing. So it kind of, it is a blessing in one sense, because then I feel like I'm not alone, even if I am physically alone in that sense. So it kind of made me see that struggle can be dispersed. Of course, it can be very concentrated and like it should be too, but also we're fighting the same thing in different places, in different contexts. Sometimes we feel we fight it individually, although it's not individual. And everything that we do, like to fight patriarchy and patriarchal capitalism, is actually not only an individual act, it's a political act. So the personal is political. So that is, I think, a strong kind of lesson for building or fighting or building movements, that and to see both how fragmented but also united our struggle is. It also gives us, I'm not saying it to say, hey, we don't have to build a unified front or actually build physical spaces where we are together. I think that's indispensable, that should be. But it also means that it also kind of gives us, I think, a horizon to see how varied and wide the struggle is in a way.
Well, talking about struggles, and to close out this episode, I'm asking you the question I ask all my guests: what is your rebellion?
that's a very loaded question. I think my rebellion started when I went to UMass. I think my rebellion started when I was maybe 10 or 12, or just like, I think existing as a woman who's like, as a woman who wants to be free, is a rebellion. And I think just like the body, not everywhere, not in the same way, of course, but someone that I respect hugely, and I've been inspired and motivated by a lot politically, is Leanne Simpson, who is an Anishinaabeg scholar, who's a First Nations scholar and thinker and artist from so-called Canada. And she talks about, by referring other First Nations scholars, that the Indigenous women's, just the existence of their bodies is a threat against settler colonialism, because that body, like that, physically embodies indigenous peoples' mechanisms of self-governance and autonomy. So getting rid of that body is important for settler colonialism. I think we can think about patriarchy in a similar way, as a woman being in certain spaces and being mobile and visible in a certain way is itself, I think, a threat to patriarchy. And you get threatened by patriarchy when you try to do that. But I think I think my first rebellion was that, trying to be where I want to be, and that itself was a threat. But I think studying heterodox economics in UMass Amherst was a big rebellion to the established discipline of conventional economics. And I still try to do that. And I keep teaching heterodox economics and ecological economics and political economy and I try to teach it to also students from mainstream economics departments, so that they might feel the fire of rebellion one day too. So my rebellion is both, I think, in academia, but also in my political activism, just to fight for my freedom and to see how my fight for my freedom is connected to other fights for freedom.
Thank you so much, Bengi, for this conversation.
You're welcome. It was a pleasure.
And thanks to all of you for spending time with us. Stay tuned with us for our next episode. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to the podcast series of the European Society for Ecological Economics. If you like the conversation and your work is related to ecological economics in any discipline, consider becoming a member of our society to stay connected. If you are ready to discuss the topic, join our Facebook group called European Society for Ecological Economics.